the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs. So that after all the choices that they have, they decided that this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects as a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them, and I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who play every note all the time. Mm-hmm. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes, they're just in different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter and Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station, WRCT, is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storen, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give him my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastman School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. And at one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We had hung out for a weekend. 1958, something like that, man. Wow, 58 or so. Bill Motzing, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is the jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It was like I've been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He was one of my friends from the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he's left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. But secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer, perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to 5 or 6 people, and it's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view, spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio when a quintet was playing in the studio and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that's not going to be, that can't be productive for the bass player, because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in the group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that that situation that they're in right there moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I played does those things, and I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and the musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room with a glass to see the other players.
Yes, I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space, where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage that the sound cannot be as impactful or as startling and sounding, because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound. By the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from David Gage in New York, a realist, that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. Mm-hmm. And as the bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quintet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote-unquote his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, the big top five orchestras from 1957 to 2024. I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you found on the internet. So having discourage is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical songs and other. Have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, school, high school orchestras and church orchestras need the extra bass players to play the Handel, the Hallelujah Chorus, or they may have a Brandenburg Society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those concert groups, and I play as many as I can as my schedule allows and the availability of them. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I can endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was, Richard, was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out, what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, now, what did I learn this past 2 and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was and translate that to the next practice time the next day? I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, this is my concern day, I guess, is that the most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play as horizontally as possible across the bass, and my exercises are based on chords. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony and what the chords sound like, and what direction the chords are headed, what's the point of this chord going from this chord to this chord, they see the result of that, they'll play the music differently because they understand the harmony behind the influence of these notes being what they are.
That's a very, very good point. And again, folks, you can find that information about the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
All right.
Now, Ron Carter, you are one of my favorite bassists. I think I told your people that you and Charlie Hayden and Slam Stewart and Dave Holland are probably my favorite bassists.
Well, great. I'm in good company.
But you have also been an integral part of some of my favorite jazz recordings. You know, the Herbie Hancock sessions with Cantaloupe Island and Maiden Voyage, and so much great work with Miles. But I still love your work in the trios. And one of my absolute favorites is that old record you made, Jazz My Romance, with Kenny Barron and Herb Ellis.
But, you know, I always wanted to play with Herbie. I've known him for a very long time because I'm a Oscar Peterson fan. And of course, Ray Brown and Ed Thigpen, he joined the band. And I said, well, my record contract list lasts 2 more records. I got to get Herbie on a record, Herbie Ellis. And Kenny Barron was available at the time my schedule opened up, and I was trumping on a bit to try to track down Herbie Ellis and where he was and could he make this record with him. Well, we had such a great fun. He's just a wonderful guy. You know, wonderful sound of the rhythm he used to play. Just a killer. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Carter.
Rich, good to talk to you. And I'm sure I'll see you in Pittsburgh. Forget to say hello.
And we're going to let the folks hear Sweet Lorraine from that very record, Jazz My Romance.
And please enjoy Kenny Barron. What a diamond he is. Thank you. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arshan Das, with my co-host,
Kate Smiggy.
And today we're going to be interviewing Max Gonzalez, also known as Gems.
Hi.
Max is a graffiti artist and muralist in Pittsburgh. He has a pretty interesting story. So I guess we'll let him lead it off. Tell us how you got into graffiti.
Yeah. So I am a full-time muralist, but I always make the distinction to say that I'm like first and foremost a graffiti writer. So like I have a very like graffiti, like traditional hip-hop lettering background. I'm originally from Southwest Side Chicago. I grew up painting there and just like seeing like graffiti everywhere I was from, because the neighborhood I'm from is Pilsen, and it's just like this very historic Chicano community that's just covered in graffiti. So I just naturally saw it everywhere I was. So even like as far as like starting to draw graffiti, like I don't even know how old I was, because I just was mimicking what I saw and what I thought graffiti was. I very much so have always had graffiti in my life. I didn't really start to like try to actually paint and get a name in graffiti until I was about like 15. I think like the first time I used spray paint though, I was like 13, just coming from like a construction background. And doing vandal type things with my dad and my brother. And from there, around like later in high school is when I started to actually really try to push it more, try to do pieces and things. But it really was when I moved to Pittsburgh for college and didn't have like parental control and kind of had free rein that I really, really started to push graffiti. So I was like age 18. I started writing Gems. Before that, I was writing all kinds of other things, but Gems is like really what stuck out to me. And just like being in a university format in a city that was unfamiliar to me and just kind of hating the college format I was in, I kind of didn't like to hang around a lot. So every night I would just go paint on things and put my name everywhere. So in a way, like me having graffiti was an access to like my upbringing to Chicago and kind of like that culture that I was brought up with. So being able to like export that to Pittsburgh and like pull from that inspiration. But so the whole time through college, I was not doing graffiti as my art form for Carnegie Mellon, but it was still always there.
Yeah, so you studied at Carnegie Mellon, like we are current Carnegie Mellon students. A lot of times when you're around campus, you hear people talking about how the environment here is somewhat depressing or suffocating. Everyone has their own opinions on that, but how do you think the environment of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon contributed to your art?
Yeah, if anything, it was kind of good that I had such a distaste for CMU, just because it forced me to seek like the actual Pittsburgh communities outside of the campus areas. Just because, I don't know, like coming from where I'm from, like I'm not poor or anything, but I come from a working class family and like work construction my whole life. So coming here and like even during school, like working two different jobs, like working at a restaurant and then like working construction during the summers, like I just couldn't really culturally attach myself to a lot of the other people here, where I was just seeing people who literally princes and princesses, and I was just kind of like, oh my god, and like children of like CEOs, and it just like was very difficult for me to attach myself to that, especially coming from like Chicago and kind of loving the more city nitty gritty side of things. So that did push me to eventually start looking into seeing the rest of the East End. So really, I've always like prided myself on like being very attached to the East End of Pittsburgh. So like East Liberty, Bloomfield, Garfield. From there, finding places like Time Bomb Shop, which used to be on Highland Ave, which is like a historic hip hop graffiti store, and Daily Bread, and finding all those friends there. Thank you to CMU for pushing me away.
I think it's sometimes great on artistic journeys to find inspiration from life and to find inspiration sometimes from those struggles that you face. And I feel like that's the uncomfortable part of the artistic journey. But when you're creating graffiti, what are you thinking about in terms of style and colors? Like, what do those artistic choices look like? Or do you come up with a design beforehand?
I mean, I would say there's definitely a distinction for me between like my graffiti and my muralism or spray can muralism. As far as graffiti inspiration, like letters, a lot of the inspiration for me does come from Pittsburgh. It wasn't until I moved to Pittsburgh that I had people who were willing to critique my style and tell me like that I sucked for the first time. And I was like, oh, wow, like I just assumed because I know how to draw, I must be good at graffiti. And it's kind of like, well, no, like graffiti is a typographic art form. It's based in lettering and this long history of hip hop. It even predates hip hop. And so I can't reinvent something that's already been mastered and that has this super strong history tied to it. It'd be wrong for me to reject the culture that it comes from young black and brown kids from New York and Philadelphia. Yeah, so I'm always looking to that as a reference point, like original subway graffiti, just wall graffiti. As far as like what I'm contributing to my style writing, and even in my murals, I try to push for there to be as much of a graffiti presence as possible. So any point that I get to introduce traditional graffiti styles into my art, I'd gladly accept it.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned the different scenes that exist in graffiti from different cities. I wanted to ask you, What are some of the regional differences that exist between what you saw in, say, Chicago and here in Pittsburgh? And how does that influence your style?
Yeah, there absolutely is like a huge distinction between different cities' graffiti styles. Like I even said, like there's a little bit of a contention between who started modern style writing, whether it was Philadelphia or New York, but they both started around the same time in the late 60s. Philadelphia has a very, very distinct style for their like very tall, elongated letters. Even all of their like pieces look like that. It's called a style called Wicked's, and it's just like this very, very gestural style that you probably couldn't even read if you weren't from Philadelphia. Where New York is known for like these rounder, more funky styles. And even being that Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, they're in the same state, yes, they're opposite ends. It's just interesting to note that Pittsburgh does not have a Philadelphia style. Pittsburgh has a bit of his own style, kind of with the advent of Instagram and the internet, styles have started to be diluted a bit. Philadelphia still has its style, but all the styles are kind of meshing a lot. The one thing with Chicago's style is that it actually kind of is very similar to LA's style because of a history of a Chicano and Cholo movement there, where a lot of the original graffiti from LA is referencing kind of like old English styles, and a lot of gangbangers from back then would be riding in that style. So even before style riding was a thing that existed. So a lot of these almost gothic, pointy, like very aggressive-looking styles of graffiti were present in L.A., and being that there was a large movement of Chicano and Cholo people in Chicago and kind of like migration between the two places, they share that style. Where definitely, though, if you go to the south side of Chicago, it's a lot more noticeable, where the north side, it's just kind of like a contemporary mix of all styles. It's Chicago definitely would not have its style if it wasn't for the Mexican-American culture that's present there. Pittsburgh, being that it has zero Mexican-American culture, besides like me and two other people, it was more receptive towards like funky styles, but also like hardcore punk styles.
Do you think, is there anything about placement of the actual lettering that differs in cities, or is it just styles? Like, are there certain places where people tend to tag more often than others based off of regional differences, or have you not seen that?
Yeah, it definitely is a regional thing so even when I first moved here, I was like, oh my god, no one here paints rooftops really, where I love rooftops, and rooftops are super common in Chicago, where you just like climb up a roof and find a sidewall and like paint something up there. I that was like one of my favorite challenges, is like finding a roof. And one thing I was taught by one of my friends is like, you can always find a way up onto that rooftop. Just like if you give up, then you failed. It's just like, there's always a way. It taught me to climb really well. I can't climb as well as I used to though. But even if you go to New York or Philadelphia, a lot of box trucks are painted. That hasn't caught on in other cities like Pittsburgh, just because it kind of would take an overnight shift of like everyone painting box trucks for it to not stick out like a sore thumb. It's just kind of, people have always painted those. Pittsburgh doesn't have subway cars. We have the T, and that actually was painted once at one point, and everyone got arrested. Pittsburgh is actually a bit well known for its like freight graffiti. Like freight trains. So it was like people like Prism, Nexki, others from that era, from like NSF crew, who started pushing freight graffiti super heavily. And unfortunately, because Pittsburgh's lost a lot of its industry, a lot of our freights have gone too. So we've definitely fallen from the ranks as being like a freight graffiti city, just because we don't have those surfaces quite as much anymore. But there still absolutely is that history there. Other cities, like if you go to like LA or Chicago, people love to wild out there, and people love to paint the fronts of like more corporate or franchised businesses. So like a Dunkin' Donuts or a Subway, or just kind of like a Motorola store or whatever, just kind of like blast it, and it gets removed very quickly. But it's just kind of like this more lawless, reckless style out there.
Yeah, so kind of on that topic, I would be interested to hear a little bit more about the legal challenges to graffiti and whether or not you think graffiti can be positive or negative for a community, and what are some of the effects of it?
Yeah, I mean, so sometimes people will bring up the argument like, is graffiti vandalism? And it's like, yes, absolutely. Of course it's vandalism. But I don't think vandalism is a disqualifier for something being art. Just because something is illegal doesn't mean it can't be art. If anything, a lot of art is born from illegal activities or what might have been illegal at that point. So it would be best to tell anyone like, yeah, all laws are off and go paint whatever you want. But usually what the best situation for graffiti is when the graffiti writers and the community have a common dialogue. So the more that the graffiti writers can see themselves as a part of the community, the less they see themselves as the villain. So the more that the community says, you guys are the evil graffiti villains and vilify that person, the more they'll say, yeah, you know what? I am awful and I'm going to ruin your day. There are unspoken rules in graffiti where it's like, don't go over places of worship, no places of education, no playgrounds, no cemeteries, not the front of anyone's house. But yeah, it's a lot of times when you see people doing vandalism or what we call civilian graffiti on places that it shouldn't be or that are like very destructive and inconsiderate to a community, it's typically not a person that is from the graffiti writing community. It's someone that is some kid or some adult or some drunk adult that is just out there seeking to destroy something in that one moment, and they might not ever do graffiti ever again in their life. So a lot of those incidents do give graffiti a bad rap. And really with graffiti, it's no one's out there thinking or saying, I want to go paint racial slurs or something like awful or make someone feel bad. It's here's my identity. I've developed this name into my identity. I'm proud of this identity. Or even in Pittsburgh, a lot of the queer and furry communities have started taking up graffiti a lot. And I see that as like a very obvious sign of like agency over identity, where even for furry communities and queer communities, being a furry, that is agency over identity. Choosing a different name for a queer person, it's writing your own narrative and deciding how it's being told and in what visual aesthetics it's being told in. Graffiti is just the same, where if I want to put up the name Gems Everywhere and I'm doing this very specific style, these very specific locations with the specific character, that's how you're wanting to be interpreted by the community. And even if you go back to the origins of graffiti, it really was disenfranchised youth who didn't see their voice out there in the world. Graffiti's always been around. It always will be around. Even if you go back to caveman times, there's always been graffiti. Roman times, were always scribes into walls. And a lot of those scribes, you'd expect them to be some sort of romantic poetry, but a lot of them are just kind of like jokes and stuff like that. And like saying like, I don't know, Pythagoras sucks. And like, I guess that'd be Greek. But yeah, so it's just kind of like learning to have a community dialogue and opening up more spaces to graffiti or sanctioned graffiti spaces. People being less afraid of letters.
Going off of that, do you think there is a distinction between murals and graffiti, or do you think people make that distinction because of the way they see graffiti, trying to separate the two, even though they're kind of similar art forms?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of language in the world of graffiti that is kind of difficult to even understand. Or even if you notice, I've been saying graffiti writer. When I'm saying graffiti writer, that's someone who does traditional hip-hop style writing. So you're writing your name on the wall. Where one distinction I make and a lot of graffiti writers make is that graffiti art typically is the form of graffiti that is done with permission or that's sanctioned, or it's a commission. So it can still be hip-hop letters, like it can still be your name, but it was just that it was done legally. Where graffiti, it sometimes gets like misused in the way that someone will call anything done with spray paint graffiti, and it's like, well, no, it's not like traditionally tying itself to style writing. where some people see the term graffiti as an insult, and it's like, no, it's just like, it's just a style. Where one distinction I make is just like, I usually just refer to murals, or my murals as like spray can art murals, where it's just spray can art. And there's even a book from the 80s called Spray Can Art, that is, I don't know, a good reference point too, just for learning a lot about graffiti. But even the term street art is very loaded. Street art comes after graffiti. Street art is actually a byproduct of graffiti and was made by graffiti writers. Where street art more so often refers to wheat pasting, stencils, and anything that's more kind of like a political statement, where in itself, graffiti writing is a political statement in the way that you're saying that I have an identity. I don't want it to be constrained or constructed by the rules of markets or capitalism. I just want it to exist. Where street art more so is specifically about a specific political subject or social issue. But street art, unfortunately, has like been co-opted a lot. Where even if you think of people like Banksy, I don't see street art as always being done as like a pure intention. A lot of times you'll see someone even do something like a commentary on like stop the genocide in Gaza, and then they'll sign their name next to it. And it's like, why do you need a sign in your name? It's a lot of co-opting. Where even in my own case, where I've done political graffiti in the past, I just don't sign it. It's just I'm doing it for the movement, for the cause. Where then sometimes you'll see people like Banksy or similar to Banksy, they'll do something like that. And it's just like super vague, and it's just a lot easier for people to consume, and people more readily look at the super abstracted, like incoherent street art and think, yeah, that's the thing that's saying something. Where they'll look at graffiti, style writing, hip hop, and say, that's just trash, that's vandalism. Where it's like, well, one of these here has a very pure intention of just saying, here's my identity, I want to be seen, I want to be understood this way. The other one saying, ooh, here's some cool imagery that is provocative or interesting in some way, I don't know what I'm saying, or I do know what I'm saying, and I want it to be rewarding for me somehow, even though I'm capitalizing off of a social issue. So it's, very contentious within graffiti world.
Yeah, I can see it. So you used to be a graffiti writer, still are today, but you would spray paint unsanctioned graffiti writing and letters on places. Now you are also a professional artist and you are commissioned to do murals. What was that transition like from being a college kid painting gems to now getting paid for your art? Is there anything that you miss from the good old days?
Yeah, I mean, with graffiti writing, having my agency and over the name Gems is a bit freeing, obviously, where now since I was arrested for graffiti in 2017, I can't write the name Gems illegally in Pittsburgh anymore without it being tied back to me, and then I go to jail because I'm on probation for the rest of my life. As far as that transition, though, since I was arrested, initially I was looking at like 2 to 3 years and like $128,000 restitution, and I was just graduating college, and I was like, oh my God, like, this is going to ruin my life. I was kind of like, all right, I need to like make some money quick. So I started making some art pieces with Gems tags on them and things like that. And with this, I'm definitely not saying that like you need to be arrested and be a number one most wanted graffiti writer to start a mural career. It was more so like, okay, I owe a lot of money. I don't owe student loans, but I owe a lot of money. Better start making money somehow. I've developed this following. People know me as Gems, and I can't write that name anymore. All right, then I'll just start using the name in a way that still gives me control over it, but not as in a freeing of a way. But if anything, what really pushed me into muralism was that I had put so many years into learning how to use spray paint and how to use it very quickly and use it in pitch black, so that when I started to do murals or was interested in murals, I was already like, had the can control. I had the ability to paint very quickly and just efficiently. And then my first mural was actually, my first like proper official mural was for Central Outreach Wellness Center, which is a health clinic for LGBTQ people and addicts and users on the North Shore. And since then, they've branched out to having many locations, and I've actually done tons of murals for them, and now they're my PCP. And so I definitely owe them a lot of thanks for that. But just kind of a lot of getting into muralism is just getting used to rejection and just approaching every business owner and saying, hey, I notice your building keeps getting tagged. You want a permanent solution to it? Let me do a spray can art mural on it. And yeah, from there, like the more murals you get, the more you get, just because it's advertisement for itself. And you can't really start to build that portfolio until you show what you're capable of doing. So if you approach some company or some store owner and they say, what does your work look like? And you're like, good. Trust me. Like, it doesn't really work that way. Like, you just have to have work under your belt.
Do you think working with the community and working with youth has been really fulfilling? I know that is kind of the direction some of your mural making has started taking.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely prefer to do the murals that are very community oriented. Probably like 2 years ago, I was doing a lot of just very quick commercial murals, a lot of like mom and pop shops and smaller brands and stuff, and also some larger like corporate clients like Sheetz and Dick's Sporting Goods and stuff like that. So I think in 1 year, myself and my business partner, Shane, probably did like maybe like 70 murals in a year, which is like nuts. Yeah. And like some of them were like very quick, whatever thing. Some of them we got paid barely anything, but we were just kind of like very hungry at that point. We were like, yeah, let's just go. And that did help build our portfolio. But one of our goals now is to start finding more clients that pay better. And then we've just been handing off a lot of those jobs to our friends because we actually run a website, dowhatwelove.com. So anytime we can't take on a job or we're like, oh, that's not really like our thing or whatever, we're like, cool, we'll transfer you over to our painting partner, Jerome or Brian or whoever. And so we've been able to like not reject all these like mom and pop shops, but just kind of like take a little pressure off ourselves. And for some of the projects where that are like more community involved, like some of those are ones where we get a grant or there's an RFQ and like we apply for these things. And sometimes they have really good funding, which is great because then we can devote a lot of our time to them. Or unfortunately, sometimes some community-oriented things just have zero funding. And anytime there is a social cause, though, like if someone has passed away due to like police violence or like, or anyone's passed away, really, like we try to offer up our services and be like, hey, we have the paint, we have the resources, just tell us where, tell us when, we'll show up, do it, and just knock it out in a day. And like, but yeah, like I would love to start doing many more community oriented, like long term projects rather than just like a drop in, meet some kids one day, be like, what's up, children? I'm here to paint a mural. Like, might not ever see you again. Good luck. I'd love to actually like be there for like a month at a time and like really focus in on the community and like do more than just have it serve as a commercial function.
Yeah.
So I really like seeing cool graffiti around the city, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners feel the same. Where in the city should we go if we want to see the cool spots for graffiti lettering?
Yeah, I mean, so we actually created Pittsburgh's only legal sanctioned graffiti space in Bloomfield on the side of Trace Brewing. So if you use Google search Graffiti Alley, it pops up, and you can actually go there anytime, paint whatever, go over whatever. And we've actually had a few friends like start their mural careers there because you can just paint anything, take a photo, crop it, and show that to a potential client so that when they ask, what does your work look like, you can show them all these images and they don't need to know it's all the same site. You just say Bloomfield. That's a cool place to meet a lot of the graffiti community, because you'll at least meet one person while you're down there that's like from the community. And then we also revamped Color Park recently on the south side, where we had them install like actual walls built out of concrete blocks. So that's another site where you can do the same thing. There's not quite as many like graffiti writers or muralists that go there. A lot of that's just kind of like general community, but those are two cool spots where, like, if you're actually looking to paint, and it doesn't matter, like, what skill level you are, like, at all, like, you can paint there. Garfield as a neighborhood has a lot of really cool graffiti, especially like Penn Avenue, First Friday area.
So kind of on that topic of the art scene in Pittsburgh, how would you say that the graffiti scene and the art scene, are they just one scene, or are they two separate communities that sometimes interact, or is there a complete division between the two?
I would say in Pittsburgh, there's definitely a complete division, just because since Pittsburgh graffiti writers have been like so pushed to the outskirts of society due to like it's like all the like prosecution and persecution of graffiti in Pittsburgh, a lot of those people don't see themselves as like normally functioning part of society. And like, so if anything, they're pretty adverse to art. And sometimes when they'll even see someone get into visual arts or try to do an art show or whatever, they'll be like disgusted by it, like, oh, you're a sellout or whatever. And the older you get, though, the more everyone understands, like, okay, like you have a family, you got to support whoever, and it, you grow up at some point. But Pittsburgh's slowly adapting to that, slowly getting used to like having its graffiti writers put on art shows. And it, although First Friday is like one of the few places that you'll see a lot of the graffiti writers present with a lot of the art scene, just because it is like so grassroots. But a lot of the art scene just doesn't know anything about the graffiti scene, and doesn't know that Pittsburgh actually has this like super long history of like graffiti writing and important figures from here, or things started from here. Like even like the most important graffiti documentary, Style Wars, it was put out on PBS 1983. Like Henry Chalfant, the director of that, he's from Swickley, PA, so like 30 minutes outside Pittsburgh. His nephew lives in Garfield, and like we actually brought him out here to do a screening of his film at the Carnegie Museum of Art. And yeah, and it's just kind of like, it's nuts that this guy who's internationally famous for his film gets like zero recognition in Pittsburgh from the arts community. And he found all of his success in New York. Yeah, just like definitely not much interest from the fine art scene in the graffiti scene.
Well, hopefully that's going to, you know, change in the future, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Pittsburgh is notoriously behind the times on many things, which is one reason why like I have my mural career, because it's just starting off here, the mural scene. Where every other city, it had started like in the 90s. So Pittsburgh is like just starting to accept graffiti art, muralism, and just kind of like the aesthetics of graffiti. Pittsburgh is like just starting to like accept like the culture of it as well.
Sure, yeah. I think that's just about all the time we have, but you've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Again, I'm one of your hosts, Archon Das, with
Kate Smiggy.
And we've been talking to Max Gonzalez, graffiti artist. Thanks, Max. Has been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
All right. Hello to all of our Is Sound a Language listeners. This is Ashley.
This is Logan.
Today we have a very special guest. We have Petra Floyd. They are a CMU School of Art MFA alumni and multidisciplinary visual and sound artist based in Pittsburgh, PA. We're super excited to be chatting with them this evening. How are you doing, Petra?
I'm okay. I feel like strangely nervous. I was like, wow, I feel like I'm interviewing for grad school again or something. Yeah. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I feel good.
Amazing. So I wanted to start with a question that you gave us, actually, which is, what is your relationship to hearing and listening as a sense?
Yeah. When I wrote that question, I was thinking about how I'm drawn to working with sound because I have such a strong response to it. I'm someone who has like different sensory issues, something I didn't become more aware of until my adulthood. And so like hearing a slight buzz or things like that, right, would be affecting me emotionally, but I wouldn't know why. I'd be like a little annoyed or a little irritated or something, right? And then I found the word misophonia. And I forget what miso means in that, but phonio, as we know, it's like sound. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, things like someone chewing or having like a, not being able to clear their throat all the way, or honestly, just not liking the sound of someone's voice. And be like, I wish I could change that. So that's a way that I became more aware of my relationship to sound as a sense. And I also do some grounding exercises, and you've probably heard of this grounding exercise, the like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown, where it's like, name 5 things that you see, 4 things that you can touch, you know, things like that. And I was finding that that was helpful for me, because as someone who like doesn't drive, for example, I'd be like on the bus or the trolley in Philly, and it'd be like, man, I'm just so agitated and irritated on my commute to work. Like, why am I so angry? Like, yeah, work is hard, but like, this is just extra. And I realized it's because I couldn't control what was happening like sonically for me. Even when you put in headphones, like someone's talking loud, you can hear the groan of the bus, like these different things. I'm talking about how sound, you know, can be a source of like concern for me, but also it's been a great comfort for me. And I would say that listening to a good like DJ set or sound podcast or something and going for a walk when I felt like my loneliness here in Pittsburgh as like a transplant was something that just refreshed my imagination, my outlook on life. And also there've been moments for me where sound has been transformative and I have just been like a weepy mess after like listening to something really good, mm-hmm. you know? So those are some of the things that come to mind for me when thinking about sound as a sense and its impact on me.
And I guess to jump off about your relationship with sound and as a sense, do you consider sound a language?
Yeah, I was so curious about the name of this class and the name of this like podcast because, yeah, there's like lots of different languages. Not all of them are sonic, of course, like written language or like pictorial language. I think sound can be a language. When I think about a language, I think about like a coherent system of some sort that like you can refer to, even if it's just a language of your own, but you can refer back to it after the fact and there still be like a